Good Thursday, January 17th. I'm Phil Picardi. This is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Today on the podcast, does having a gun in the home put family members more at risk? A county sheriff in Minnesota says he won't enforce new federal gun restrictions. Expectations for pull tab revenues are shrinking. And relax and pull a tab. Have a beer. President Obama's next chief of staff could be a man who grew up in Minnesota. Dennis McDonough is currently a national security advisor. The Associated Press reports a decision has not been made, but sources tell them McDonough is a front runner. The 43-year-old McDonough grew up in Stillwater. He graduated from St. John's University in Collegeville. President Obama says he intends to nominate Minnesota's U.S. attorney as director of the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Rupa Shenoy reports.
B. Todd Jones has served as the ATF's acting director since late 2011. At the time, Jones noted in an interview with NPR News that he was the fifth acting director of the federal agency and said the lack of stability takes a toll. Jones replaced Kenneth Melson, who was criticized for a sting operation that allegedly resulted in guns falling into the hands of criminals in Mexico. Jones served as Minnesota's U.S. attorney from 1998 to 2001. President Obama appointed him to the position again in 2009, and Jones has continued as Minnesota's chief federal prosecutor while serving as acting director of the ATF. His nomination as ATF director must be approved by the U.S. Senate.
That's Rupa Shenoy. President Obama's proposals for reducing gun violence include a directive to the CDC to renew its research on gun injuries. More than two decades ago, the CDC angered gun rights supporters when it reported a gun in the home is more likely to be used on someone who lives there than on an intruder. Brant Williams reports some Minnesota gun owners dispute that data.
Late last year, the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service issued a report on gun control legislation that included competing estimates of how often Americans use firearms in self-defense. The Bureau of Justice Statistics National Crime Victimization Survey found that on average, about 62,000 Americans use a firearm to protect themselves each year, and another 20,000 use a gun to protect their property. The government's report also cites a University of Florida survey, which estimates that 2.5 million people a year use guns to protect themselves. One of the thousands, or perhaps millions, of instances where a gun was used in self-defense happened to Felicia Herman 21 years ago. Herman was sleeping next to her now late husband in their South Minneapolis home when she felt someone touching her. She says she knew it wasn't her husband because he was sleeping on the other side of the bed.
I remember thinking I was whispering, but apparently I was shouting, "There's someone in the room."
Herman says her husband yelled that he was getting his gun while he grabbed a .22 caliber semi-automatic pistol from the bedroom and ran to the top of the stairs. She called the police, but says the burglars must have heard her husband mention the gun and took off.
And they decided they did not want to see what kind of gun that we were getting out. So we did have a situation where we did, in fact, have no shots fired.
Herman's experience is similar to that of some of the self-reported gun owners who responded to an NPR News survey of our Public Insight Network. About a dozen of the 87 respondents described an incident where they used a gun to defend themselves. Nearly all of them reported that they didn't have to pull the trigger. A few wouldn't disclose any details. Felicia Herman is the widow of Joel Rosenberg, who was an author, gun rights activist, and firearms trainer. Herman, who is a research librarian, says she and Rosenberg decided to become gun owners after examining all kinds of data. However, she thinks some of the information is flawed. Herman says she's particularly wary of the CDC's research conducted in the 90s, which concluded that a gun in the home is more likely to be used to harm a resident than an intruder.
Yeah, I think CDC has already taken themselves out of the field. They've already issued one politically biased report, and there are many people that would not trust them to do one that was unbiased.
Herman says she believes the research is driven by anti-gun bias because it focuses too much on the presence of guns and not on other factors that might influence outcomes.
The public and special interest groups need to understand that the scientists aren't doing this to make a political point.
Charles Brannis is a PhD who conducts research at the Firearm and Injury Center at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine in Philadelphia.
Scientists are doing this because they want to generate knowledge and figure out the truth about a particular question.
In 2009, the American Journal of Public Health published Brandis' study on the link between gun possession and gun assaults in Philadelphia between 2003 and 2006. Brandis concluded that on average, guns did not protect those who possessed them from being shot during an assault. He also concluded that while successful gun defense does happen, the probability of success is low. Brandis says he'd like to see more research done on the subject, especially at the federal level. And at the local level, there's little information on the frequency of guns used in self-defense. A Minneapolis Police Department spokesman says the department doesn't have numbers for how many times people like Felicia Herman's husband chase an intruder out of their house with a gun. However, the department does have numbers for justifiable homicides. There have been 10 killings over the last 3 years in Minneapolis that were committed in self-defense. In two of the cases, a person used a gun as protection. People used knives to defend themselves in the other 8 justifiable killings.
That's Brant Williams in Minneapolis. Some county sheriffs across the nation have said they won't enforce new gun laws they believe to be unconstitutional. One of them is Pine County, Minnesota Sheriff Robin Cole. He sent a letter to county residents outlining his objections, and he spoke with Kathy Werzer today on Morning Edition.
Here's the issue. If the federal government is going to propose a change in current law, then they need to do that through the legislative process, not through mandates, not through regulation, not through executive orders, but through legitimate legislative process. And the federal government, of course, can do federal legislation that would blanket the entire country, but we have to remember that the laws that are enforced in the states are state laws. Really, my stance is this: until that legitimate legislative process occurs and that new law goes through the judicial review process, we're not going to enforce it. We currently don't enforce federal law.
Well, there are federal laws covering things like speed limits and civil rights and the right to remain silent. You enforce those laws, right?
Well, the right to remain silent isn't a law, all right? Speeding is a state statute, but we enforce it under state statute, which means that law was passed by our state legislature. If the federal government wants X, Y, and Z to happen, they can operate within the purview granted to them by the Constitution. Now, the federal government issues licensing for manufacturing, for importation into the country, for interstate commerce of firearms, that kind of thing. They can control that all day and all night. We have nothing to do with that.
But when you're elected Pine County Sheriff, you took an oath to uphold the law, and I would think that that would include county, state, and federal laws. So I'm still not clear. How can you justify not enforcing a federal law?
That's a very good question. And here's the answer to that. We currently don't enforce federal law. We're not allowed to enforce federal law. We don't enforce immigration. We don't enforce customs. We don't enforce environmental law. We enforce no federal law. We are not allowed to. The federal government, for instance, look at these southern states, the state Arizona and Texas, with the battles down there over enforcement of immigration. The federal government has told local municipalities not to enforce immigration laws. So, is the federal government now going to pick and choose which federal laws it deems local law enforcement to enforce? The other point is this. I am not an agent of the federal government. Local law enforcement is simply that, local. If we didn't operate that way, we would have a federal police force, which we don't.
You wrote the letter to Pine County residents.
Correct.
Why did you do that?
Well, we have been inundated with requests for permits to purchase and permits to carry firearms to the point that we're paying overtime to process them within the state-mandated time limit that we have to turn these things around. We have gotten so many of them in. And the reason that I'm finding, after with talking with people and people coming in and people calling and meeting with folks, is that they're afraid. They're afraid that their right to buy a firearm, their right to keep a firearm, is going to be taken away. So basically, they're getting while the getting's good is the best way to explain it.
That's Pine County Sheriff Robin Cole on Morning Edition. President Obama's call for stronger background checks and limits on military-style assault weapons is winning the support of some Minnesota city leaders. Laura Ewan has that story.
Both Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback and St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman say they applaud the efforts of Obama and Vice President Joe Biden to help curb gun violence. Coleman, a hunter himself, says it's time for the national conversation on gun control to go in what he calls a different direction.
Well, I think we have to decide who we're going to listen to. Are we going to listen to the NRA that opposes any kind of reasonable dialogue or restrictions on the purchase of these high-capacity magazines? Or are we going to listen to the families of the people that have lost children in Newtown or lost a loved one in Arizona? I think that this is a seminal moment for the country to decide, are we going to be reasonable and are we going to protect our children? Are we going to protect our community?
The National Rifle Association said in a statement responding to the Obama proposal that attacking firearms and ignoring children is not a solution to the crisis we face as a nation. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Paul.
This is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. State officials concede they're likely to miss even revised estimates of how well electronic pull tabs will do financially. That was the word at a House Commerce Committee meeting last night, called to look at the plan to pay for a new Viking stadium. Tim Nelson says the situation has Minnesota lawmakers pondering backups to their backup plans.
Lawmakers said they wanted a better look at how the rollout of new electronic pull tabs was going 8 months after they legalized the games to pay for the state's share of a new Viking stadium. And they didn't much like what they saw last night.
I am more concerned than I was before the hearing started.
That's DFL State Representative Joe Atkins of Invergrove Heights. He chairs the House Commerce Committee, which oversees charitable gambling, the lottery, and betting at horse tracks. He called the meeting to get a status check on electronic pull tabs that were expected to be in thousands of bars and restaurants as soon as last fall.
The newly revised revenue projections that came out, those are, I believe it's 120 sites that we currently have. It's anticipated, based on what the Department of Revenue representative said, that we will have 2,500 sites in place by July 1st. And I just don't know how realistic it is to expect a 20-fold increase between today and July 1st.
The new electronic pull tabs were expected to give more than $1 billion boost to charitable gambling in Minnesota. Taxes on that gambling expansion have been earmarked for the stadium. But electronic pull tabs grossed only about $4 million in their first 3 months of operation. And the game's average daily handles, or the bets they take each day, have also bumped down below half of last year's projections in recent weeks. Minnesota hasn't yet borrowed the $350 million it pledged for a new billion-dollar Viking stadium in downtown Minneapolis, so the finances haven't reached a crisis. But the state doesn't have much time to figure out how to make the payments. Groundbreaking is scheduled for October. Eden Prairie GOP Representative Jennifer Loon, who sits on the Commerce Committee, says this is why she voted against the stadium deal in May.
This actually was one of my primary concerns, whether or not the funding stream was going to be adequate to cover the state's portion as allocated under the legislation. And, clearly the estimates are not coming to fruition.
And she's already running through some of the what-if scenarios.
You know, one of the issues that we had looked at was a ticket tax for people buying tickets at the stadium. We do that with other venues, whether it's theaters or other things that are being renovated. I was disappointed that wasn't one of the fallback provisions. Maybe that's something to be looked at.
There are already some automatic backups built into the stadium plan, including a tax on suites and a sports-themed lottery game. But lottery officials say the last Vikings-themed scratch-off game in 2010 only yielded about $1.5 million for the state, a far cry from the tens of millions in debt payments needed to fund the stadium. And with a projection for about 150 suites in the new stadium, $1,000 per NFL game surcharge on each of them would only raise another $1.5 million. But lawmakers on both sides of the aisle say it's too early yet to hit the panic button. Al Lund, executive director of Allied Charities of Minnesota, represents about half of the state's 1,200 charitable gambling operators. He assured lawmakers that bars, legion clubs, and bingo halls are still up for the challenge if they get the chance.
We are pro-electronics. We're pro-stadium. I tell our charities, you can now point to that thing and say, we helped build that. And we would ask for your patience. The rollout, when the electronic bingo is available, when all the distributors that want to distribute electronics have products to sell, those numbers are going to go up exponentially very quickly.
Lawmakers, though, said they're going to keep the stadium plan under close watch. They now want a monthly report on how the business is shaping up.
Tim Nelson at the state capitol. Also there yesterday was Elizabeth Stewicki. She was there for the first vote on a Minnesota insurance exchange bill. It cleared a Senate committee on a party line vote.
About 1 in 5 Minnesotans is expected to use the online gateway to comparison shop for health care policies and enroll in Medicaid beginning in October. A 7-member board would run the marketplace, and each paid $55 a day plus expenses. But Senator Sandy Pappas, who chairs the local government committee, offered an amendment setting pay at $30,000 a year. The St. Paul DFLer worries few will want to do the amount of work required unless the pay is higher.
I want us to be able to attract a wide variety of people, not just people who are independently wealthy and can take time off.
Another change in the bill, all board members would be appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. Elizabeth Stewicki, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Finally, Minnesota is catching up with the U.S. beer boom. In just the last 2 years, the number of breweries in the state has nearly doubled. Curtis Gilbert reports on what's driving the proliferation of local beers and introduces us to some of the people making those brews.
Steady as a metronome, big bubbles of carbon dioxide rise off a fermenting tank at Dangerous Man Brewing Company in northeast Minneapolis. It's one of 14 new breweries and brew pubs licensed in Minnesota last year. Dangerous Man doesn't open for business until next week, but Rob Miller has been planning this place for a long time.
Well, in 2004, once I started home brewing and just fell in love with the whole brewing process and kind of figured out, like, there's not a lot of breweries in Minneapolis. This would be an awesome thing to bring to the city. We actually wrote a business plan back then.
I made him write a business plan for it.
Sarah Bonvalet is Miller's wife and business partner.
We kind of had a mock-up, and we spent maybe 2 years kind of talking about it and really putting our heart and soul into it. And that's when we discovered that it was absolutely illegal to have a microbrewery in Minnesota that actually served their product.
The business plan went back on the shelf, and there it sat until 2 years ago. That's when the legislature passed the so-called Surly Bill. Surly Brewing Company, which lobbied for the change, is actually one of the larger breweries in the state. But the law also opened the door for many smaller beer makers who can now sell their beer by the pint right on site. It's called a tap room license, and a Roseville Brewing Company, Poor Decisions, just got one last week. Kristen England is one of the owners. With a PhD in pharmacology, he's a bit overqualified for making beer.
You know, the last 5 years is doing research on bone marrow transplant and blood progenitors and such.
The only other employee is England's similarly overeducated business partner, BJ Hahn, who has a doctorate in genetics. England says they both plan to continue their scientific careers during the week, while they devote their weekends to making beer.
Because it's a hobby anyways, right? So instead of spending the time on the hobby making beer, we're actually spending the same amount of hours, you know, here making beer commercially.
That's not to say this is just about fun. England takes it much more seriously than that.
So when people say, oh, when you love something, it's really not work. No. It's still, I love my kids, they're work. I love brewing, but it's absolute work.
It's undoubtedly a lot of work. But these new breweries aren't making a lot of beer compared to more established companies. Consider that Miller Coors, the largest brewing company in the country, ships about 100 million barrels of beer a year. August Shell Brewing Company in New Ulm is the largest brewer in Minnesota. It does a fraction of that, about 130,000 barrels. And these new brewers operate on an even smaller scale. Poor Decisions is planning to make just 2,000 barrels a year to start. Dangerous Man is shooting for 500, and there are breweries popping up that are even smaller than that.
Hello, I'm Ken Thieman, owner, brewer, secretary, delivery man, bathroom washer, dishwasher, and a jack of all trades here at the Borealis Fermentary.
Thieman has brewed only 30 barrels of beer since he started in April, but he beat out much bigger companies and snagged two of the top awards at last year's All Pints North Festival in Duluth. Thiemann's brewery is attached to his house near the north shore of Lake Superior. Trained as an engineer, he built both structures himself out of timber, straw bales, and 65,000 pounds of stucco.
And always I built it in mind with, hey man, if the brewery doesn't work out, this is going to be a really killer canoe building workshop. See, if you don't set yourself up for disappointment and you don't overshoot your boundaries, well, then you don't have to worry.
But Thiemann has no intention of going into the canoe business now. He plans to upgrade his current system, where he brews one barrel at a time, to a rig that can handle four or five. But Borealis will always be tiny, even by microbrewing standards.
Now people say you can't make money with a small brewery. Yeah, you can. You just can't have employees. You can't have snowmobiles. You can't have four-wheelers. You have to deliver your beer in a Yaris. You have to know how to be small.
It's the common thread running through many of the new breweries. The owners aren't looking to strike it rich. They just want to turn their hobby into their job. With reporting help from Dan Crocker, I'm Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
That's Curtis with some tough duty, checking out craft beers and small breweries, just doing his job. I'm Phil Picardi. I'm on the Daily Circuit program tomorrow, but you can get Minnesota's news on your schedule from John Wanamaker, and this, the NPR News Update.